Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with William Franke, Professor of Comparative Literature, Italian, and Religious Studies, about his forthcoming book, A Philosophy of the Unsayable. William, thank you for being willing to be part of this interview.
Well, thank you too, Chris, for doing these. It's really a tremendous service to all of us, I think, to share our work this way around the community.
Great. I should mention to our listeners that we're doing this interview by Skype, so it hopefully everything will turn out fine. I am in the U.S. and William is in France, and this is the only way we can do this. So it'll be an interesting experiment. All right. I wanted to begin by asking two questions that derive from your meditation in the first chapter of your book on the intense need to speak about what is unsayable. In a general sense, what do you mean by the unsayable? And what is the need that you talk about, even more specifically, what is your need to talk about what cannot be said?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me resist the temptation to personalize that question too much. I could talk about my psychological temperament and the career reasons for the choices that we make about what we write about. But there are also reasons that are valid for all of us, why all of us need to talk about, even if it's indirect and unconscious, about the unsayable. You ask me also, what is the unsayable? That's another question, actually, that I want to try and dodge, I'm afraid. There is no what is. It doesn't answer to the question what it is. It's there everywhere, however, and in some ways I suppose it's a mistake to thematically focus it, as I do right from the very title of my book, and as I invite you to do then inevitably in this interview. And the reason that we have to do that nevertheless, that we have to turn our attention, I believe, to the unsayable, is that everything that we say works on a logic of exclusion. That's the very nature of our language. Sense is oppositional. Our concepts have sense because they define a certain content exclusive of what they don't include. It's A and not A. It's the very nature of speech. And that is a predicament that condemns us to certain kinds of conflict, and that loses a kind of vision of the whole. To the extent that we're concentrated on what we're able to say in speech, we're always focusing on some things at the expense of others. That's necessary. It's necessary for thinking, and yet we have to try to recuperate what is being blended out, what we are making ourselves blind to at the same time. So in order to try and turn the corner on this inherent and inescapable oppositionality of saying, we have to open a space towards the unsayable. We are in relation to everything, even as we're talking about one thing or another. And that relation somehow has to factor in to our thinking and into our discourse, even though we can't grasp it within any given discourse, within any word, because of this nature of the word to be exclusive. So, one of the contentions that's announced really from the very beginning of the book is that we are always speaking from or out of the unsayable. It's there in the margins, it's in the background, and it is decisive for everything that we do say. Now, we encounter it explicitly when we run up against the limits of language. Mm-hmm. And that's when we become conscious that there's something more than what our language was grasping. That is the moment in which we take consciousness of this predicament. And so I think that's where we really feel the acute need that you're pointing to in your question.
Mm-hmm. Now, your new book is interested in doing several things with regard to the unsayable. Some of those things including describing its logic and its workings, discussing how it's revealed in literary, philosophical, and theological texts, arguing that, and this is a quote from the book, literary exploration of language as infinitely open points language, eminently the language of philosophy, in a direction which is best understood as theological. So there's the links between literature, philosophy, and theology that you're going to be taking up in the book. Now, I'm hoping we can touch on a number of these issues in the interview. Of course, we're not going to be able to do justice to everything. But I did sort of want to work through the book and bring up some topics. We've already talked a bit about the book's first chapter. You move in the second chapter to what you call a philosophical meditation on unsayability. And that's where you begin to lay out a little bit more about what you were just saying about unsayability. In this chapter, you discuss a number of concepts, and some of the central concepts in the chapter are truth and totality. And one of the figures that you engage with is Hegel. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what these concepts of truth and totality, and what this person, this figure, this philosopher Hegel, how do they relate to the narrative of unsayability that you're wanting to develop?
Mm-hmm. Well, Hegel's philosophy is emblematic of the totalizing systematicity of classical philosophical thinking according to the Logos. And that's why he's become the target of attack from so much recent philosophy, much of it in a postmodern vein, reacting against all figures of totalization. Critical theory was very strong in this. Adorno, Benjamin, came out very powerfully against the totalizing tendencies of logical discourse culminating in Hegel's philosophy. And when I was a graduate student, you were not allowed to speak in terms of totality and even truth. They were scorned as concepts that had proven to be obsolete, and even worse, they were dangerous and to be avoided. And I am trying to turn the corner on that and to define the ways in which we do need to consider truth and totality, to bring them back into our discourse. I suppose the reason I was alluding to earlier on, that we always are in relation to a whole, an unspecified whole. And if we ignore that, we become partisan, partial. We're not responsible without limit to all, which is actually the vocation, I would assert, of our human being, of our status as speaking beings as well. The Logos itself calls us to a kind of unlimited universality. The problem with the Hegelian model, as it's vulgarly understood anyway, is that it becomes an overarching system. It imposes one structure on all, absolute knowledge. Now, that is a problem if the system is articulated in language, if it is a certain discourse, a certain logical system that is spelled out and articulated, yes, then it becomes oppressive because it excludes all that it cannot say. Mm. And I do, there is reason that that has to be critiqued. It has to be infinitely critiqued. But if you carry out that infinite critique, then even the countervailing, the anti-Hegelian discourse itself is ignoring a larger whole. The only way to get out of that deadlock of partiality is to make room to allow for the unsayable that embraces us all, embraces whatever our discourse may be and whatever an opposing discourse would be. We have to relate beyond our own discourse. And one does this then by a self-negating move. This is already part of Hegel's dialectic, of course. However, if he does it always within his discourse, then there's always going to be the objection of about what has been excluded. Hmm. But I don't think that, you know, if we simply settle for anathematizing any talk of totality, we do cut ourselves off. It's a mutilation, really, of thought, and we're not going to be able to reach true universality. One of the sort of non-concepts that I try to deploy in order to break out of the strictures of logical thinking is the figure of the not all. And this, you know, this comes from Rosenzweig. It's really my most direct source for it. Das Nicht alle. It's become, I think, more commonly taken up from Lacan, and he develops an idea of the patou. Psychoanalysis is one discipline in which one has to go beyond concepts in order to feel out one's relations, even where they're not articulated in the unconscious, maybe dream language, if it's a language. It can, of course, exceed the limits of logical language. Hmm. Poetic language is crucial for reaching beyond the concept as well. And in particular, I concentrate a lot on epics. In this book, I don't talk about epic literature, but I do talk a lot about poetic language. The reason why epics are so important is because they do propose a total vision. The Bible is really one of our, you know, the archetypal epic narrative. And then, of course, you know, there's Homer, Virgil, the Divine Comedy. They do present, there's the imperial ideology moving through the tradition of the Aeneid through the Divine Comedy. There is definitely an attempt to think the whole, but it's never a whole that is defined in strictly logical terms. It's an imaginative whole that can be glimpsed and that opens inevitably to an infinite series. That the not all is, it puts you into relation with the all, but every articulation of that whole, that all, is not it. Mm-hmm. And so that projects you into this dimension of not all. This, I consider this to be a new approach to universality, where we're not talking about a concept that can draw a circle around the whole and define it, but that circle is broken open to unlimited relatedness, always to others, to any and all others that come. And I do find this already dramatized, actually, in the epic tradition by virtue of the poetic quality of its language. But that really is that is a separate project that links with this one. Maybe just one more comment on this topic is I mentioned Benjamin Adorno, who have had so much influence really in distancing us from any attempt to try to think in holistic terms. I just like to point out that actually they're in some ways they're very close to Rosenzweig. Benjamin, in particular, Benjamin does have a notion of the whole of history being radically turned around, reversed by the messianic moment. The messianic moment, this Jetztzeit, this time of the now, can change the whole of history. And Benjamin is not afraid to mention this whole of history. He speaks of how the singular moment, this Einzelmoment, can actually help us and is necessary to enable us to discover what he calls den Kristall des Totalgeschehens, the crystal of the whole event. There is that dimension, but it is a dimension that's broken open, that can't be gathered in to the concept. And it's within that tension, really, that the thinking, the philosophy of the unsayable works. It's a philosophy that's not just philosophy. It breaks open to the other discourses that you mentioned in your question, notably theology, which in many ways it's about the unsayable par excellence, as well as literature, which is, again, a word that is open to infinite other meanings than whatever conceptual meaning can be assigned to it. That's the nature of poetic language.
And you mentioned literature, which is actually a very nice segue into my next question. You were talking about the epic traditions and the fact that you don't discuss them in so much in this book, but you do work with some writings by Edmond Jabez and Paul Celan. And it is in this chapter that you're dealing with sort of this fragmentation and the whole that cannot be spoken. You say in this chapter in your reading of these writers that there are two distinguishable lineages and logics of apophatic thinking, and what apophatic meaning what cannot be said. So what we've been talking about to this point sort of falls into that umbrella, I guess, in some ways. So that you say that there are these two distinguishable lineages and logics of apophatic thinking, one based on the ineffability of the singular existence, whether of God or of the individual human person or event, and another based on an ineffability inherent to language itself. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about these two lineages and how Jabez and Celan exemplify them.
Well, I suppose the first point that I would make is that they are very much intertwined and inextricable. And I separate them out for analytical purposes. They enable us to, I think, each one can illuminate the other. The lineage that I label as linguistic would really go back through Kabbalah tradition, notably, where everything is created out of the word and out of the letters, really, of the Torah. There are parallels with much equivalent kind of thinking in Christian and in Muslim traditions, the Sufi mysticism, for example. In this tradition, then, it really, one starts with the word, and the unsayable word, and the unutterable name of God is the prime instance, the tetragrammaton, that one would avoid speaking and say Adonai or Lord instead, which is a relational term, rather than trying to name the divine itself in its own essence. We can rather say something about our relationship to it. Mm. But it's approached through the name and therefore through language. There's a whole culture about the unsayable that grows out of the experience of language. And Jabez reflects this. His whole corpus of writing is constantly about the book. The name, his approach to the unsayable is linguistic in this sense. On the other side, there is being, existence, that also has been thought as an instance, as the prime instance of the unsayable, from Plato through medieval mysticism and Baroque mystics to Schelling and Wittgenstein. Being itself is what we can never say. Anything that we do say is only some aspect, some attribute. And there's a very rich tradition. Even the traditions are interconnected, but they are distinguishable nevertheless, and they have different approaches to what turns out to be, I think, a common objective. In discourse, they're different, but they're about what's beyond discourse in both cases. Mm-hmm. And that's where everything does actually come together. And we have to allow for that further dimension beyond our discourses. It's not easy to do, to the extent that we are invested in our discourses and trying to bring them to their own perfection. But their perfection turns out always, in some ways, to be their defeat. That is, it's when they are crushed and broken open. And even this schema of these two different traditions, that too is heuristic, and it comes into its truth when you can see that actually these are just two angles at trying to get at the same mystery. Although every word I say is under erasure when approaching that, whatever it is. You know, there are problems with calling it mystery as well. That seems to make it something that we have a name for, and that has to be broken, as every discourse, every characterization, every name has to be broken open to let this infinite pour out of it. And that's happening in the texts of Ceylan and Chavez, in all of their words and in all of their poems. They're really fascinating examples of this. You can find it, you know, much more largely diffused throughout literature, and it's a literary dimension of many texts that don't even have pretension to literature. But you can really find the quintessence of it epitomized in their poetry.
Hmm. I wanted to actually quote you at some length on both Jabez and Ceylan on this whole question.
That's a good idea. I was just thinking I have to have a quote, but yes, you go ahead, please.
Yeah, and hopefully it's a useful quote. A useful couple of quotes, but then I want to, you know, ask a couple of questions that come to me out of these quotes. You, in your discussion of Jabez, you note his distinction between the divine and the human word, and then this follows a relatively lengthy quote. You say, divine language is characterized by being inaudible, except in and through our words. It is like the hollow of a ring, and here you quote Jabez. The divine word is silenced just as soon as it is pronounced. It is on to its sonorous rings, which are our inspired words that we grab hold of. Unquote. Back to you. In fact, a divine word is created precisely by its own absence. It is created in human words by the abyss that inhabits them, the emptiness at their center. It is then human words that create the infinite insofar as it can be apprehended or articulated at all. Words make absolute what they name and define and thereby annihilate as extra-linguistic entities, for they substitute ideal entities, meanings which language projects, for the supposedly real things. Thus, Jabez's rabbis, characters in his works, can maintain that anything is at all only by virtue of being named, yet this named ideal entity or essence itself is but a delimitation, an inflection of nothing, the essence of language. So that's a quote from your book about Jabez, and then which I kind of paired with a quote from the book on Ceylon. You write.
The chapters, the chapters on Jabez and Ceylon.
Right. Exactly. Yes. You write, and this is a quote in Eng Xiong. Ceylon exhorts his reader to read no more but to look, and then to look no more but to go into the fields where those who died in the concentration camp lie narrowly together. This spells a way out, a pragmatic exit from language, which in being silenced has led to something that cannot be communicated verbally, but can only be directly experienced, unquote. And when I read this chapter and these quotes, they seemed contradictory to me in a way, and I think you've kind of talked a little bit about how they may not be, but I'll just lay out my sense of their contradictoriness. On the one hand, human language, as Jabez is saying, is integral to the creation of the infinite. Even if it can't capture the infinite. On the other, human language seems to be an impediment to the experience of the infinite, and we have to escape language to experience the infinite. So you've mentioned how these could be synthesized, so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, my seeming sense of contradictoriness here, and then how they can, how you see them being synthesized, particularly perhaps in Rosenzweig's writings, as well as the work of Jean-Luc Nancy, whom you cover in a chapter that follows.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge question,
yeah.
But
well, I think fundamentally the paradox that you're pointing to is that this philosophy of the unsayable, even in pointing beyond language, wanting to get away from language, is itself nevertheless intensely focused on language. There is something paradoxical about that. And it really is through language that we have to pass in order to get beyond. By concentrating on language, as the sorts of philosophical thinkers, including Nancy, that I'm really foregrounding here, as well as the poets and the religious thinkers as well, they all have a certain focus on language, but language is not the object, really. It is a vehicle that implodes. It's really the imminent collapse of language that is under inspection, I would suggest, in apophatic thinking, the philosophy of the unsayable. It's not that language as the traditional structure of reference, within that referential function, saying remains intact. It has its object. But when there is no object, when we're using language in relation to the unsayable, the language itself comes apart, implodes, explodes, and opens this dimension of the infinite beyond the segmented world that language gives us when we stay within its terms. So the reason why it is a language-oriented kind of philosophy, but what is language? It is itself just a step to a beyond, and with language, then everything else is that as well. There is a sort of a dissolution of any sort of defined segmented being and word. So we have these two dimensions, really, of being and word working parallel here once again. And rather than taking any units within those dimensions as ultimate, one opens the perspective to the universal relatedness of all with all, of every unit with every other. And to that extent, then, the focus is no longer on language. It's on the other of language. Language is negated. So the concentrated gaze that is turned to language is a way of negating language, opening it to the other beyond language. It is this operation, really, of negative. It's a double negation, because language itself is always already a negation of the whole. But it's the word is a negation of the thing, that it's not the thing, right? It represents the thing, it signifies the thing. You have to negate that negation in order to let the thing be. And I think once we really start thinking in these terms, seeing the negativity that's always already there in our language, we can see the beyond. It frees us from this segmented, dichotomizing form of reasoning. It's the negation of the negation, which language is, that is aimed at. Now, just to try and make that a little bit more concrete, let me mention a couple of poetic figures that come up obsessively in both poets, really, in Celan and in Chavez. They represent words as freezing reality, as killing its always shifting, changing life. Language reduces the dynamic to the static. This is described by both of them, actually, in various poems as a kind of a poisoning. The word is a poison. Every word somehow poisons that which it is produced to convey. It's the death of the live impulse that gave rise to it, and that it would express, but it betrays that expression because it fixes it. And you know what the antidote to this poison is: not to avoid language altogether, but to reflect on it, to negate its negativity, so that it can rather be the opening to the infinite that is the real of anything. There's anything to the extent that it is part of a whole, of the infinite, and it is that to the extent that you want to take its relations as constitutive of it. It's only really by this negating of the negative definition of the word or the concept that the thing can present itself in its full reality, not poisoned and killed by the word. Another metaphorical register that comes up all over these poets is that of the wound. Mm. The word is a wound, fundamentally, and perceiving it as such then leads us to ask, well, has it been torn off from? What is that greater whole that the word cannot speak? The word testifies to it in the form of a witness. Here's this wound, right? There's been some sort of a violent cutting that has taken place whenever we're dealing with the word, because as such, as a defined, segmented sense, it has been broken off from the larger whole, the body, that it functions within, that it has its own life and meaning from. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that we hang on to it as a word, and of course we inevitably do that, it's bleeding. It's bleeding its life out beyond its own bounds. So, I think that there's a powerful motivation for this kind of imagery in terms of the philosophy of the unsayable, that both poets are not in those terms, but nevertheless in the kinds of thought and imagination that they carry out, executing or manifesting.
Between your discussion of Jabez and Ceylon, and then your exposition of Jean-Luc Nancy's evolving thought about the unsayable, you provide a brief survey of Neoplatonic negative theology, which you've mentioned this earlier in the interview a little bit. So we begin to move, I think, here from in the book from your discussion of the unsayable in literary texts to a discussion of the unsayable in philosophical texts. How does this discussion of Neoplatonic negative theology provide what I call a bridge between your analysis of Jabez and Ceylon and then your engagement with Nancy?
Well, Neoplatonism is a bridge from philosophy to theology and also to poetry. There's a tremendous culture of poetic expression that grows out of Neoplatonism in its various historical phases, beginning with its early Greek appearance with Plotinus in the 3rd century AD. This is where the Logos breaks open to the infinite, reversing some of the canons of classical Greek philosophy based on logical thinking, the principle of non-contradiction that is articulated by Aristotle in Book Gamma of the Metaphysics. Historically, Neoplatonic negative theology informs the kind of thinking that I call the thinking of the unsayable that we still find showing up in modern writers like Jabez and Ceylon and in a philosopher like Nancy. However, and I want to say something, of course, about Nancy in answer to your question. Mm-hmm. First of all, I'd just like to specify that I'm revisioning Neoplatonism in some important ways, not as a dogmatic system, which is the way in which it's often thought of, with these elaborate structures, the archontes and hierarchies of being, and there is all of that. it is a systematic kind of thinking. Hegel actually takes it up very much with enthusiasm. Proclus is one of his prime sources. But behind that system, there is a sensibility for the unthinkable, the unsayable, what cannot be articulated in any system. The first principle, the so-called one of Neoplatonic philosophy, transcends any attempt to think it or to say it. If it's one, how could it be said? Because already saying institutes a difference between the thing and its name or description. There's very concentrated probing meditation on the unsayability of the supreme principle, the one, from the beginning of Neoplatonic thinking. And actually it goes back to Plato's Parmenides. That's really what the Neoplatonists are reading. Plato already makes this problem absolutely starkly evident. But the real breach between the ground of everything that is and the universe of phenomena that we experience opens up in a later day and age, after the classical age, in the Hellenistic period. You know, I suppose the unity of the world was crumbling as the Roman Empire was challenged. The signs were written on the wall. In many ways, this period of history is parallel to our postmodern age, in which foundations dissolve. And that it's that breakdown, I think, even in historical, social, political terms, that is expressed also in this thinking of a breakdown of language, system, the unity of the world. There's a breach, really, at the very core and origin of everything. The unsayable is what escapes from any system and unified order. So this, I think, is what brings Neoplatonism really close to our contemporaries, and what gives it a very different spin from the ontotheological, metaphysical discourse that it has typically been equated with. It then can be, I think, a bridge to a thinker like Nancy. There's another crucial element in Nancy's thinking, which is Christianity. Which Christianity, of course, takes over Neoplatonism and synthesizes it together with biblical revelation. The Christian thought is really this hybrid, and then Nancy is thinking rather specifically in I do actually go through even some of his earlier works, but it's especially the deconstruction of Christianity, where the deconstruction is not just applied to Christianity as an object, but becomes the work of Christianity as the agent. So the deconstruction that Christianity introduces into all of Western tradition, it's doing it, it is performing this act of deconstructing the logos and the whole of the tradition that's built on that, by acknowledging what transcends logos, this unsayable instance, which is approached rather in faith as a giving up of knowledge, as a letting of it, or as the kenosis of sense, the self-emptying of any sense, which does then open up to the nonsense beyond it, to what it cannot say or encompass.
continuing with Nancy for a moment, in your treatment of Neoplatonism and Nancy, you say towards the end of the that particular chapter, the following: philosophy or reason thought through dissolves itself and opens towards its other in adoration. This I take to be the quintessence of religion, or of the original impulse that inspires religious modes of thought and expression. The philosophy of the unsayable, as I see it, is religious thinking in the sense of opening to the infinite relations of religio, and finally to relation with the infinite, unquote. And you've said how Nancy was focused on deconstructing Christianity as deconstruction, and now we have, I guess, as part of this movement, a focus on adoration. So I wonder if you could unpack some of this, both in terms of what Nancy says and in terms of the understandings you've come to in your dialogue with Nancy. Specifically, what is adoration? How does it come out of what Nancy was saying about Christianity, about the unsayable, and how can we have a relation of adoration to the other, to an other that is infinite, to an infinite other?
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm hesitating here between starting in on adoration. First of all, let me say that I want to present religion as first philosophy, right, in the sense of religio that you quote, that is of tying back to a source or an origin. Traditionally, religion has been a special area of application after the fundamental inquiries of logic and metaphysics and epistemology, which became first philosophy. Epistemology becomes first philosophy with Descartes and Kant in the modern period, whereas metaphysics was, of course, first philosophy, and that was the philosophy of being for Aristotle, being qua being. Then, you know, Levinas makes ethics into first philosophy, which is really a revolutionary move on his part, insisting that we have already some sort of an ethical orientation. We are in relation to others before we even begin thinking and reflecting on being, or asking the question of how do we know what we think we know. We're already there in relation to our fellows, and we have to really deal with that first. That's going to condition. It's imperative that it condition anything that we think. Now, I would like to take that kind of a revolution one step in another direction, and that is to acknowledge that this relation to the other is not only ethical in any narrow sense. It is broadly religious. Our ethical stance is part of an orientation to the world, to the cosmos as a whole, and maybe even to what's beyond any cosmos that can be articulated. It should not be isolated and absolutized, as Levinas tends to do by his ethical emphasis, and he had to do that in order to make his point. And it really does open the whole universe of philosophy to the other. However, you cannot stay in place in thinking, and I think that we have to make a kind of religious turn, and really to reconceptualize religion as first philosophy, inasmuch as it does place us face to face, yes, with the other, with the l'autre homme, with the other person in front of us, but not only. that other is also infinitely open to what we can neither conceive nor articulate. That is the dimension of religion. It's very often figured in terms of God, divinity. Any of those terms are going to become idolatrous if we think we know exactly what they mean, then that becomes a form of conceptual thinking. Now, obviously, as parts of tradition of revelation, they have conveyed powerful parts of the human experience in relation to the absolute, and they are the richest symbols that we have to work with. But I do want to refer them beyond themselves to this always wider field of infinite relation, where the dimension of the religious is to be found, or is to be faced. Maybe we can't find it. We're lost within it. We have to be found by the other in that infinite open space of the religious. Now, this, I think, is the background then for understanding what Nancy means by adoration. That is, it's obviously, it's my way of understanding this. But what Nancy is trying to get at through this term, adoration, is turning outwards towards the other. Ad is the Latin preposition for towards or to. Oration, of course, we can hear a word for prayer. But I think even more fundamental than that is, well, certainly just ora in Latin means limits and the edge. And this is going to and even beyond the edge. Even more specifically, we can hear in the term adoration certain cognates like, apart from oratio is prayer, but the mouth is orum, orifices. All of the orifices of our body, I think, are relevant to understanding what has to happen in adoration. We have to go out of ourselves in this kenotic movement, and this is the essence of Christianity as Nancy is discovering it through his deconstructive philosophy, which is in some ways the philosophy of the Western cultural tradition as he constructs it. But, you know, fundamentally, I think it's this ecstatic opening of the body through all of its orifices to what is beyond it that is the sense of adoration. But of course, Nancy is a philosopher of sense as always the unmaking of any achieved sense, and its opening in adoration towards other, further sense and even nonsense. It's venturing into that abyss that is the fundamental gesture of adoration, opening the world upon itself to a transcendence in and from its very immanence. You know, so the other in question here is really not an abstract infinite. It's the other in the infinite others that we are surrounded by here on earth, and that we share the world with in common. This is maybe the other key term that I would like to bring up to complete the portrait here of it's not a portrait of Nancy, but just the key concepts that I'm trying to take from Nancy. It's also important to see this adoration as an opening to a common being, a being with, as Nancy, he really emphasizes, the with is all there is. He gets this from Heidegger, mit sein, being with. But in some sense, it's the with is really where everything else comes from. you know, who are you, who am I, what or who is anyone else, we don't know in and for itself. It's only in terms of being with one another that any of that can be revealed. The very idea that, or the very word common, and this is an etymology that Nancy himself does actually allude to, comes from munos, which is the word for gift, and co. We are co-gifted. The sense of the common is being co-gifted. And recognizing that in relation to, you know, whatever this gift is and wherever it comes from is crucial to the sense of adoration, as Nancy is developing it in his book by that very title, Adoration. That's the second volume of the Deconstruction of Christianity.
Will, you move from Nancy's discussion of adoration to two final chapters, other than the brief conclusion, in which you discuss something called radical orthodoxy. And we're going to cover two chapters in a question, so obviously we're not going to be doing justice to what you have to say. So you're in this chapter, you discuss radical orthodoxy, its relationship, its complicated relationship to negative theology, and a possible rapprochement between radical orthodoxy and secular theology, which you also discuss. I do want to touch on, obviously, we have to touch on these chapters at least a little bit. So I want to, it's kind of a high level view, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit first about what radical orthodoxy is, and why of the variety of possible contemporary theological movements, this seemed to be the one that you wanted to work with in discussing discussing the relationship, some of the relationships that are going on in theological thinking. And then I did get a sense, and perhaps this is part of the reason why you selected radical orthodoxy, that you seem to have some sympathy for this particular approach. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Well, radical orthodoxy is a movement springing up between the University of Cambridge and the Anglican Church in, I think, the late 1980s, 1990s. It develops. The leader, the recognized leader, is John Milbank. Around him, Catherine Pigstock, Graham Ward are key figures, as is also the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. And they are finding a new way of presenting traditional Christian faith and theology that responds in many ways to our postmodern predicament and to some of the groundbreaking philosophers of postmodernism, like the French, Derrida, Deleuze, Bataille. Their response tends to be very critical and even acrimonious in many instances. However, what I want to emphasize is that it's really this postmodern turn in philosophical thinking that makes radical orthodoxy possible. Mm. What they are taking from the postmodern thinkers is the thoroughgoing critique of any form of Enlightenment rationalism. That modern paradigm collapses. And it's we owe that realization, recognition in many crucial ways to these post-structuralist, postmodern thinkers. What that does for theology is it makes the traditional narratives of Christianity plausible once again in a way that they seemed not to be in the age of the hegemony of scientific discourse. That kind of rationalism seemed to tell how things really happened in the beginning, rather than the myths of Genesis. But because of the critique, really, of rational, any rational discourse, that itself turns out to be a rhetorical performance. Science itself has to admit that what it's proposing are metaphors and models for a reality that is always infinitely more rich and complex than it can possibly grasp. And to that extent, one narrative is as good as another, or the differences cannot be made simply in terms of one is true and the others are fiction. They're all, in some degree, fictions that answer to various kinds of needs. And theology comes back strong, answering to the needs to tell us who we are, why we're here, what kind of relationship we're supposed to have with one another, with nature, with the source and origin of all things. I think that rational orthodoxy has been empowered by these postmodern discourses that it nevertheless, for the most part, faces off against in order to condemn nihilism, right? Postmodern nihilism is a constant target of attack. Now, what I'm trying to point out is that this kind of critique, the radical critique of rational discourse, is actually a theological resource from the very beginning, specifically in the tradition of negative theology. Now, of course, these theologians are perfectly well aware of that. However, they are very reluctant to embrace negative theology. It's been shifting in some recent publications, but the original stance was quite critical of negative theology because it had been appropriated by the postmodern secular philosophers who were doing a kind of a negative theology without God. Negative theology seemed to be all too vulnerable to that kind of atheistic appropriation. Now, that's true. And I think one has to go with that. Meister Eckhart himself, at the medieval height of at least one form of negative theology, you've got Maimonides before him, you've got Cusanus after him. But Dionysius the Areopagite before him, they all are acutely aware of the proximity, in some sense, in some discourses, even the indiscernibility between their negative theological theism and atheism. The point really is to break out beyond any ism whatsoever, and beyond language whatsoever, because any linguistic formulation of the divine is going to have something idolatrous about it. This has been the fundamental insight of negative theology from the very beginning. You find it in the gospel, in the Bible itself. The recognition that, of the Deus absconditus, God withdraws from any, even that he reveals, but he is ungraspable, even in that revelation, ungraspable to our intellect in terms of any definition, in terms of a language. Of course, then you live the truth in relation with the Logos manifest and incarnate in flesh and blood, or even in the synagogue. There would be some kind of an incarnate presence as well. In in discourse, in discourse that is constantly undoing itself. I'm thinking here of the dialectic between the rabbis and their apophatic methods. Radical Orthodoxy is capitalizing on the way in which negative theology has been put back, I think, in the forefront on the contemporary intellectual scene by these postmodern philosophers that turn out then to be the arch enemies. And nevertheless, what I'm trying to say is that we have to recognize that it's really negative theology that is the fundamental insight that is powering both Radical Orthodoxy in its reaffirmation of certain orthodox formulations, the narratives of Christianity once again, but also of radical secular theology, which in many ways stems from the death of God theology in the 1960s. They too, I think, have gone through the realization of negative theology. There, they too want to distance themselves from negative theology because it always becomes theology once again, and that seems to then go in a metaphysical, onto-theological direction. But it doesn't have to do that. Negative theology actually opens us towards experiencing the infinite, the unsayable, in the body and in the experience of art and beauty and poetic language. These are the fertile areas that are really opening up now to being developed in negative theological or apophatic terms. We have the apophatic body is actually the title of a recent book. So I think that once radical secular theology and radical orthodoxy are able to admit that both of them are really building on the fundamental insights of apophatic thinking, that the motives for conflict between them will be diffused. And let me quote a poet on this. Wallace Stevens represents the death of God as the death of our concepts and names. So in Notes Towards a Supreme Fiction, it says, Phoebus is dead, Ephebe, but Phoebus was a name for something that never could be named. Right, Phoebus, the name of God, right? Apollo, a pagan name for the sun god. And he's speaking here to Ephebe, the learner in a philosophical school. It's interesting how the names echo each other. In some sense, we are the ones that we are invoking when we invoke the name of God. Phoebus is dead, right? This name of God is dead. But Phoebus was a name for something that never could be named. So it's really only the name that is dead, and that, you know, whatever else, that is still there as much as it ever was, and it's now coming back and manifesting itself in unprecedented ways in our day and age. And this is what the philosophy of the unsayable is trying to respond to. Stevens, after that, he says, the sun must bear no name, right? The source of life and energy must bear no name, gold flourisher, but be in the difficulty of what it is to be. And that's really where we are in contemplating the unsayable. We're present in being, but in the difficulty of what it is to be. So I take the philosophy of the unsayable to be a critical philosophy and an infinitely critical philosophy and theology. Theology is, the reason I privilege theology is because I see it as an infinitely self-critical discourse, because it hands the very faculty of leveling critique, ultimately, you know, out of its own hands into thy hands. Commend, the theology commends its spirit and its very spirit of critique. That's an even, in some ways, a deeper, more powerful critique than philosophy is capable of with its rational, intellectual critique. And this is why philosophy turns into what I'm calling theology or religion in its unrestricted relatedness. And there are many philosophers that are thinking in this direction. I think I do actually even derive this from critical theory in the following of Adorno Benjamin, a philosopher theologian like Stanislas Breton, who is of course less known, but is a formidable thinker. He takes the critical resources of philosophy as well in this kenotic direction of unselfing. That is really the vocation of thinking as much as the vocation of the Christian.
Earlier in our conversation, you referred to the wound, to the wound that language represents as a tearing off from the whole, and that got me thinking about the whole notion of healing, which kind of leads me to this question about something that you mention a number of times in your book, and I'd like you to elaborate on perhaps a bit. At various points in your book, you gesture towards ways in which more serious consideration of the unsayable could have salutary consequences in terms of peaceful relation to others, justice, and so on. In fact, in the last chapter before the conclusion, you say the following: "I argue that a contemporary philosophy of the unsayable, extending the traditional insights of negative theology, can serve to break down and defuse these antagonisms, which reflect and foment potentially violent and destructive conflicts in society today." And the antagonisms I think you're referring to are things like religious wars. Can you explain some of your reasons for this conviction that you articulate here? And I'm also wondering if you could talk a little bit about this. That is, you acknowledge in the book that there are a lot of people with more absolutist beliefs than you're presenting in your own arguments. How do you imagine the development of a critical mass of people who would be willing to admit to what I see as sort of a coupling of their beliefs with an apophatic sensibility that tries to push beyond the absolutism that they hold?
Mm-hmm. Well, the absolute needs to be given its due. Mm-hmm. I think that's maybe the most important point. If we deny it, we don't escape it. However, in language, nothing is absolute. And, my philosophy, the philosophy of the unsayable, starts by focusing on this difference that language makes in order to allow the absolute to be absolute, but to distinguish it from everything that we as humans can handle with our language. This simple but critical distinction helps to distance us from our own ideologies. Yeah. I'm not really arguing against fundamentalists per se. They're right, I think, to perceive something absolute. And it's, apophaticism is really not anti-anything. This shouldn't be taken as a swipe against, all of those fundamentalists. However, there are certain ways of then attaching oneself to what is absolute, what one holds to be fundamental, that do become deleterious and destructive. And I think it's really by recognizing how right one is to see the need for the absolute, to recognize it as absolute, that I think we might be able to bring those who fragment and insist on their absolute against other people's absolute, bring them back into what you call a critical mass. Because it is by infinitely critical thinking and infinitely self-critical thinking that we can, I think, move in this direction. But we shouldn't idolize critical thinking either. Because critical thinking that is infinitely critical of itself sees the reasons for dogmatic thinking. Mm-hmm. That belongs to a certain stage and nature of humanity. Parents have to be categorical with their children at certain stages of development. There are reasons for authority, dogma. Gadamer was very good in bringing this out in his hermeneutic thinking. And tradition, of course, is the other term. I think we want to give all respect to all of those dimensions of human experience. However, they are all broken open by relation to the absolute. And if the fundamentalist remembers that, it breaks open his or her own discourse as well. They really want to, you know, if any of us really want to witness to what we call God, we're going to have to let it be more than what we have understood and can convey in our words. And we're going to discover that by dialogue with others, by learning from them how they try and approach this absolute, and letting the absolute operate between us. I can't really control that dialogue. I can't put a frame around it. We have to really open to that, you know, ungraspable, unsayable otherness, and trust it. That's not easy to do in mm-hmm. all circumstances. I think it has to be borne in mind as at least an ideal horizon. There are certain circumstances in which one protects oneself or one's own society against the threatening violence of others. However, what's the purpose of that? None of us is going to survive forever. The best we can do is make a gesture of giving ourselves up for one another. And so I don't think we want to absolutize our own survival or that of our nation either. Mm-hmm. The nation is there to witness to something, to a humanity, and even whatever humanity comes from, whatever is beyond humanity that enables us actually to be human in the sense that we want to be that. So we are aiming at something absolute, but we cannot command that. We are commanded by it. We have to let ourselves be commanded by it. It's, you know, the words that we have cannot grasp it. They are not it. They are fragile and inadequate means of relating to it. I say it, and of course, you know, this is that, just that open space. That's witnessed to in one's own self-critical, canonic, you know, self-critical negation, canonic giving up of self. I think that it's cultivating this sort of a sensibility for what I'm figuring as the unsayable, and making the distinction between our discourse, any discourse, and that absolute instance that is beyond all discourse, that helps teach us to be more willing to hold onto our beliefs more loosely and tolerantly. Mm. Although these beliefs are about the absolute, none of them themselves and the formulations that we give them are absolute. Right. So, you know, we don't really have anything to fight about once we recognize that. We have everything to learn from others and their difference from us and the discourses that they're maybe insisting on in a pig-headed way. Why? Why are they so motivated? There must be something that is inspiring them. Now, there's a lot of fear in all of us, but there's probably something else that legitimates, in their mind, their adhering to, you know, in that absolute way. I want to learn what their intuition of God, if that's what they're talking about, is, or their intuition of whatever it is that makes them so absolutist. So, you know, I think that there's a sort of a therapeutic aspect in the philosophy of the unsayable as well, and meditating on the unsayable in a Wittgensteinian way that enables us to dissolve linguistic traps. Mm. Of course, Wittgenstein has actually been deployed against the apophatic in a recent book by Kevin Hector called Theology Without Metaphysics. But he sets up the Wittgenstein's philosophy as therapy against the apophatic alternative. But he's making an important point about philosophy as therapy, but he's making apophaticism into a discourse rather than into an ontotheological metaphysical discourse. That's what I'm trying to get us away from, that form of thinking about apophaticism. It is discovered really in the concrete experience that I was referring to, also in the experience of language, which is maybe not concrete, but in the breaking open of poetic language into infinite constellations. And now I'm thinking Mallarmé. I actually restrained myself from evoking who is my main witness for the language of the ineffable in the Paradiso. But there's really a line then to modern poetics in Mallarmé, Rimbaud as well. That's probably another discussion. It's another book for me, in any case.
Speaking of the future, this is my final question for you. I understand you're starting up a graduate program in comparative philosophy and religions at the University of Macau, and that you're looking into incorporating Eastern traditions into your larger project on apophatic philosophy. Would you happen to have any preliminary findings that you can share, or is that the topic of another conversation in the future?
No. That's very much underway. I've been there since January, and my research on apophatic traditions, which developed in a previous book called On What Cannot Be Said, of which the first volume really deals with ancient, medieval, and Baroque. It actually goes through the Baroque period. Then the second volume takes up with Romanticism and goes to postmodern thinkers, but they're all in the Western tradition. The idea is to develop then a third volume dealing with Eastern forms of apophaticism, and this is really what has led me to the East. And it's very, very, very rich. The apophaticism has, in many ways, finds its native ground in Eastern cultures. I'm working now especially really from the Chinese, Taoism, and even Confucianism has a kind of apophatic strain in it. Hegel didn't understand Confucius. There were no propositions that he could sink his teeth into, and is this right or wrong? It's it's, you know, there's a lot of dodging. Confucius is not saying, right? He's the sage is withholds much more than he says. Mm. However, I'm actually, you know, more than the anthology of Eastern apophatic thinking, I'm incorporating my discussions of Taoism, the Zwangzi, the Book of Changes, I Ching, even the poetic classics of you know China, the Shi Jing, the Book of Odes, are very much a part of the a book that's called The Universality of What Is Not, mm. Apophatic Paths from Europe to China. And this book will have a geographical axis in which, you know, Europe's intellectual trajectory as the opening of universalism is compared with China's vocation to a kind of universalism as well. And each of them is actually necessary to deconstruct certain elements of the other that do become totalitarian and restrictive. So I am very much making now the dialogue with Eastern forms of apophasis part of the continuation of my thinking, specifically on the theme of the universal. Thinking as universal means that it has to break out even beyond thinking. Thinking is not enough, it has to be doing. Pragmatic philosophy has known that all along and tried to present it in various ways. And I'll just mention that my main guide for this is François Julien, as the premier intercultural philosopher. He's a sinologist as well. And actually, we're going to have a colloquium here at Cerisy in France in September with François Julien. And I'm hoping to interest him in my project and actually to bring him to Macau as well. And I'm also hoping in some ways to wean him away from a certain anti-clerical strain in his own philosophy, which is absolutely brilliant. And I consider it to be apophatic through and through. However, it's really part of contemporary French culture as well. There's a typical left bank bias against the theological. Everything that he's saying, you know, and I just want to redefine the theological for him so that he can embrace much more of the Western philosophical tradition that we share in common. And he appreciates it, but he doesn't appreciate really what theology is doing within that tradition. He sees it as what has to be weeded out from our tradition. But no, it's actually theology and negative theology is the way to get access to the apophatic roots of our own Western tradition that complement so wonderfully the apophatic lessons that we can take from the East.
Well, I look forward to talking with you in the future about this new project that you're working on. And I thank you for the conversation we've had today.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks so much for doing this. It really is, I think, just a tremendous service to all of us to enable us to know what others of our colleagues that, you know, I've heard so many things that I would never known about if it were not thanks to these interviews. So please carry on. And yes, I intend to be in touch next time around.
Great. Again, I've been talking with William Franke, Professor of Comparative Literature, Italian, and Religious Studies, about his forthcoming book, A Philosophy of the Unsayable, which will be coming out from the University of Notre Dame Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and look for the Ask Us link. And just send those comments or send any questions you might have. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.